This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
Hi-ho! This is Coach Jen from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Mary Kitzmiller from Kemp, Texas. And you are listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for November 14th, episode 2312. Today's show is brought to you by Horseware. Good morning, Horse World.
What is your favorite day of the week?
You never stop learning. You never stop understanding. It's more in depth than just riding a horse. Knowing that for the rest of my life I could work on this and I'll never stop learning.
Hi. Welcome back, Mary. Mary Kitzmiller is here the second Thursday of every month on Horses in the Morning, where usually myself and you get to geek out on all things horse training. How you doing, Mary?
I'm doing pretty good. It's been very eventful in the last month.
Oh my, really eventful. Well, I know you had a recent clinic that you did. I'm trying to remember. Was it New Mexico?
So I actually did three clinics in 3 weekends and all in Texas.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. So we did the clinic. So our guest, Gerilyn Caldwell, who was on here last month, I did a co-clinic with her and Ellie. I cannot pronounce her last name. She's from Switzerland. She's a fantastic Pirelli professional. So it was two Pirelli professionals and me. I was the I was the odd one out.
You were the independent trainer.
Yes.
Mary. Yeah, you're independent.
Yes. So I wasn't speaking the lingo, but I think we were all pretty cohesive on, you know, our styles of different, but complementary. So that was a fantastic clinic. And we're already making plans for next year. I'm really excited about that. And then I had a private clinic at my place the weekend after, and one of the auditors helped organize that, Mo Meyer. And we had a few people for that one. It was really fun. And then I did a clinic up in Gainesville for, we had 18 people show up to this one day clinic.
Wow.
I set my limit for 15 and they overbooked a little because you always have people call the day of.
Right.
And
horse got an abscess. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I don't want it. It's cold, you know. I made the mistake once of scheduling a clinic in July in Texas, figuring everyone who's coming to the clinic lives in Texas and they know how Texas gets. And they dropped literally like flies. They're like, I don't think I can haul my horse in the heat. I'm like, you live half an hour away and he lives in the heat. He'll be fine. But it was pretty hot and miserable. We did it in one of those coverall arenas. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what their ad says, but they are not well ventilated. It was like a sauna in there. It just held in all the heat. So I hope that's not a sponsor.
Now, was it a coverall that the long sides of the building came all the way to the ground?
Yeah, it was completely enclosed. So it was probably just not
ideal.
Smart design on the builder's part. Yeah, it was hot. So we had that clinic so that's all three of the clinics that I had over the weekend. And it was so much fun. I enjoyed it. Can't wait till I do another one.
So
it's been great.
You had three clinics, 3 weekends in a row. So we have two things we're going to have to make sure we cover today. First, your clinics, because invariably, as the clinician, having done a few clinics, the clinician learns as much as the participants do every time out. Sometimes the clinician learns things that are way outside of horse training. Sometimes it's learning something about yourself, Sometimes it's something you learn about your outlook or your point of view. Sometimes it has something to do directly with horsemanship. So what were your takeaways from this group of clinics?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, why is ringing. That phone ringing? Yes, I didn't realize my landline was up here. Sorry. What I tend to learn at every clinic, training horses is one subject matter that you could spend your life learning how to do. And being a clinician, it's not just horse training. In fact, it's very little horse training. You're trying to relay that information to people, so you're learning how to teach people. So that's what I get from clinics. And the thing that always hits home for me as a really good reminder is the fact that, you know, I do this 24/7. I spent years of my life crying in the back alleys of barns as an apprentice because I got yelled at all the time. And I eat, sleep, breathe horsemanship for so long and had it pounded into my brain, literally, sometimes by hitting the ground many times, that's how I built my knowledge. And you kind of take for granted that it becomes part of your marrow, and you sort of gloss over and forget when you were learning how to do it and mm-hmm. someone had to sit and explain it to you over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And so there are some things that I'll do with a horse that I'm like, yeah, this is really, really simple. And I don't try to act, I'm not meaning like in a condescending way, like, how do you not know
that's
this?
That's called unconscious competence. When you get to that point where it does become part of your DNA, it is not part of your conscious thought process. That's science is what that is.
Oh, good. Yay, science. So I forget that, at one point I did not know how to do this and I had to break it down in very simple steps so that I could learn. I had to make a ton of mistakes. And so I'll be teaching something and in my mind, it's a very basic process, or I tend to get imposter syndrome. I'm like, no one's going to be impressed by this, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's what I tend to think is that, oh, they're not really going to care. Everyone knows how to do this. I'm not doing anything special. But after I'll show something, someone will bring something up like, oh, I hadn't thought of this before. And that really wakes me up and goes, and tells me, oh man, this is not something everybody understands yet. And this is where I need to, the next clinic, when I start the introduction of what I'm going to do, this is what I need to explain of this is an important point in what we're doing. And this is why this is going to help you. And so every clinic that I do, this helps me more and more and more figure out how to break it down more easily and explain why this is important. So I get better every time. I try really hard.
Well, and that varies a little bit with each clinic you do too, because each clinic you're going to have a different variety of humans as well as horses and their knowledge level and their learning style and their confidence. All of that is different every single clinic. So that whole process of reading the crowd, as they say, if you want to use a term used in the entertainment industry, to read the crowd, read the audience, read the horses, read the situation, and you kind of adjust on the fly. It's not a case of this is my routine. When you're doing a demonstration, it's very different. When you do a demonstration, there is a limited number of variables. Okay.
Right.
The particular animal you're using, if it's different, or if you're bringing your own, it's less different. But the circumstances and the situation are going to vary a little bit, but pretty limited. But when you're doing a clinic where you're teaching and trying to get the group to gain confidence and gain skill sets, the variables are just lots.
Oh, and sometimes within the same clinic. I'll have a lot of clinics now where the crowd that shows up is very educated because we live in this age of technology. This whole natural horsemanship movement clinic thing has been going on for decades now. So I will, like the clinic we did with the Pirelli professionals, all of those people were years-long students of either, you know, of any of the trainers there. And their horses were, oh my God, they were so nice. So you have this whole group of, they're at this level of, yep, they've got the basics. Now they need refinement. They need to know, okay, you don't need to do so much of this basic thing anymore because your horse is fine with this. Now you can start working to finishing your horse, which is, I love that. I love, love, love that subject because I don't think enough clinicians are out there teaching it mm-hmm. because most of the time, you're teaching to the crowd that shows up. But as we get more and more generations of horse people that have done so much homework and they've been following whoever trainer they like and they've got their horse to this really lovely level, I love saying, okay, you know, now you could do it with feather light pressure. You could put your stick down, your whip down. You don't have to use that anymore. So that's really fun. But then on the flip side, I'll have clinics where I'll do a couple of clinics with those, that really educated crowd. And then I'll do a clinic, say, the next weekend with folks that just haven't been exposed to that before. They might be super, super expert with like working cattle, working on a ranch or trail riding, but they haven't really broken down groundwork and things like that. And so I had someone at a clinic years ago that had their epiphany, and they said, so you mean the stuff we do on the ground relates to what we're going to do when we ride? And I was like, yes, you're in for a world of fun, because once you get a hold of this groundwork stuff, you're going to realize you've got an amazing tool. So it's fun either way, whoever you're teaching. I like bringing it to people maybe for the first time. And then I really like showing people who've done all the kind of real basic stuff. Okay, your horse isn't a colt anymore. Now you get to get into some really fun refinement stuff.
And that moment when you realize, well, it's, you realize that groundwork and under saddle work do relate to one another. I think that's difficult to, at an intellectual level, you say, yes, they do relate, but on an actual doing things with the animal and the human, putting those two together is amazingly difficult.
It is.
How do I apply that thing I just did with my horse where I ask him to yield his hindquarters on a long line? What do I do with that? I don't have a long line on my horse when I'm sitting on his back. So we're going to take a note. Cover how groundwork and under saddle work are directly related on the next episode. So that
yes, because I have like a novel's worth of thoughts on that. And that is actually something I was showing people at the last clinic. Their groundwork was on point, but I had to show them, okay, you need to do nearly the same thing that you're doing now, but you need to think about how is this going to work when I get on their back. And so sometimes it's just real minor adjustments that helps it click for the horse. Like, oh, this is what we just did on the ground. And for the rider as well. So yeah, that's a good topic.
I think that's interesting. And then if you have a remedial horse, because the vast majority of us out there in the world are not starting young, new horses, we're riding what you would call remedial, or a horse that's already, quote, trained, using my air quotes. It's quite the reverse. What you're doing under saddle relates back to the groundwork. In other words, this is an issue you're having under saddle. This is how you start to address that issue from the ground and work your way back up again. So it works both ways.
Exactly. There was a trainer who said, I was at a clinic and she would say this saying, she'd go, everything is everything else. And it's one of those like mind-bending sayings that at first it doesn't make sense and maybe it's too simplistic, but it keeps entering into my head. And I say it all the time, and I'm not sure people get what I'm saying, but if you really think about that, everything is everything else. It like turns my mind in knots, but it really gets me thinking on everything I'm doing, how it relates to everything else that I'm doing. That's a little too trippy, but it's kind of a fun thing to think about.
So we have in our notes about epiphanies and rewarding small steps. So tell me about this. There goes some horses galloping by my window. Whee!
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it's okay. They weren't my horses. But they were supposed to be galloping by the window, so we're cool.
Oh, good.
They're
good.
Not my horses, but they're supposed to be out there. Because sometimes when I say that on the show, for longtime listeners, they'll know that the show has to stop for a moment.
As long as they're not trampling through your daffodils and they're, you know, or out on the road.
Yeah, we're cool. They are safely contained in a paddock. They're just having a little bit of hijinks this morning. The weather here in Ocala, Florida has finally turned to autumn. It's a chilly 50-something degrees, and the horses are all feeling
Wow, that's cold.
That's freezing for us. I was wearing a jacket.
That's even cold for Texas.
Yeah, it was chilly this morning, so the horses are all feeling a little spunky. Anyhow, yeah. I digress. Squirrel. Breaking down small steps. Regular listeners know that Mary and I talk about small steps frequently because it's a great concept, again, to know at the intellectual level, but actually applying it to your horsemanship can sometimes be harder than you would think. So first, just give me a 30,000-foot view of what it means when you have small steps.
So this all relates to three different students at the clinics over the 3 weeks that had the same epiphany, which is this idea of rewarding the small steps. Now, when I say that, you're probably like, well, yeah, that, you know, I know what I'm doing, but I think we don't tend to think of it sometimes, especially when we're in a challenging situation with our horse. So, you know, kind of a very general view of it is when we're trying to get our horse to do something, and usually this occurs when we're trying to get our horse to do something he doesn't want to do, we tend to think of the finished product rather than what's got to happen along the way to get that product. So, you know, I've hammered this home many times on the show, trailer loading. When I'm leading my horse out to the trailer and I'm thinking I'm going to put my horse on the trailer, we think exactly that. We're not going to stop until the horse is on the trailer, divider closed, tied in the trailer. I can close the door now. But if your horse is telling you no, what I usually see is the horse makes a little try, gets nothing in return for his try, and then he never tries again until you've got to get really extreme to get him in the trailer, or you don't get him in the trailer. So, when you're, you know, don't just think about, I want my horse in the trailer, all 4 feet on the trailer with the door closed. Think about every little thing he's doing along the way that you can tell him, you're doing great, keep going. You're doing great, keep going. Because that's going to save your butt, especially when you have a limited amount of time to get this horse to do something like getting on the trailer. It seems like it would take forever doing that, but it will save you hours and heartache and tears and lots of pain on both ends.
So that's interesting. That it's so funny when we do our pre-show meeting that nobody gets to hear. We should start playing that on the live feed. That'd be a little bonus because it can be pretty funny sometimes. Over the weekend, I took Nigel, and for folks who aren't regular listeners to the show, Nigel is a thoroughbred. I can't call him an OTTB because, to the best of our knowledge, he never actually raced. He went to training, but I think that's as far as he got.
Ah.
He's a bit of a tractor of a thoroughbred, so I totally get why he didn't race. Took him cross-country schooling with a friend, and I've had Nigel for 3 years. And this is the first time I've taken him. This is the third time he's seen a cross-country course since I've gotten him. The first two times he saw cross-country courses were quite disastrous. And I say saw a cross-country course because we weren't schooling. We were just riding in one. And they were quite disastrous. He was terrified of everything. Way over threshold, to use a science-y term for training.
Yes.
Meaning that his brain was quite involuntarily gone into flight mode. He wasn't learning anything. It was all about damage control. Let's not get chucked on our butt. Let's not run off. All those things.
He's operating in the sympathetic nervous system.
Yes. See, we're very science-y today.
Yes.
Yes. So our goal when we went on our cross-country school was to stay within threshold. It's okay to get close to that, oh, we're a little excited, but to stay where learning happened.
Good.
That was our goal, because once he gets into that, he's very hard to get back. He's taught me things. Once he gets past that threshold, it's very difficult to get him to come back. So I have to practice a lot of tiny little gentle touches towards it so I can get a feel, because his indicators of I'm getting past threshold from my point of view are pretty subtle. I've had to learn to pay more attention to him. Some horses, as they get close to threshold, let you know right away. But he waits until it's too late and he blows up all at once.
Yeah, sometimes they can go from zero to I'm going to take everyone out in the room with me in a minute, in a second.
Yes.
You know, it takes one bunny running across the field and there we are.
There we are. So that was our goal. He had been to the facility several times before, but had never ridden on the cross country course. We rode in the ring. So we took that ingredient out. Again, that was my small step. First, go there and don't go anywhere near the scary cross country course. We went towards the really quiet open field area. Next time we went from the quiet open field area towards the riding arena that had jumps in it. Less scary. So this was our third trip. And the goal was to get onto the cross country course. That was my whole goal. Get onto the cross country course.
Good.
Now, long story short, he was stellar. He was quiet and relaxed and kept breathing. And we jumped lots and lots and lots of tiny little cross-country jumps. And we're talking tiny little cross-country jumps. If the jump was too big to walk over, it was too big for that day. Because, again, I wanted the whole day to be completely about success. Nothing challenging here, Nigel. This is easy. You can walk over this log. Now let's trot over this tiny little log that you can walk over. And that's how the day went. Until we got to the water jump.
Oh, no.
The day had been going stellar. He kept getting better and better and better all day long. And as we came back around the course back towards the trigger, there was the water jump. And I said, well, to my friend, we'll just walk over to the water jump and we'll look at it and we'll walk around it. We got, I would say, 60 feet from the water jump till he got a really good bead on the fact that there was water in there, and it was game on. It was amazing to me, the complete and utter change in everything about that horse. It was bizarre. It was absolutely bizarre. He went from Mr. Cool doing all these things that have always been challenging for him with complete and utter confidence, the cantering along on a loose rein and hopping over little jumps and coming quietly back to a walk and hanging out and watching his friends do the same. And he got there and he did a 360. I'm out of here. Well, we got that under control so I wouldn't fall off. And I tried to figure out how far away I could be where he stayed quiet. That was our baseline. Okay, we have to be 75 feet away from the edge of that water jump. And a water jump, for Western folks, a water jump is nothing more than a man-made pond the size of a small round pen. That's what a water jump is. And it's surrounded by little jumps. So we walked around and walked around and walked around. But it was interesting because for the next 10 minutes or so, as I walked around what I felt like was outside of the fear zone, he became incredibly reactive to everything. Places in the turf where a jump had been before and the grass was brown were terrifying. He would leap straight in the air and run away from them. A bird that landed near him, he leaped the other direction and ran away from it. And all of this occurred within about 30 seconds. He turned into that horse. And I've never experienced anything like that. Have you?
I think, yes, yes, I have, because I work with Mustangs, and that's kind of what they do. Like, Dougal, chill dude. Like, if you watch me work with this horse, you'd be like, why haven't you put 50 rides on him by now? And I'll lull myself into thinking, you know, hey, he's really calm, and then he'll meet my farrier. All I wanted to have happen was not even to have his feet trimmed, just to let my farrier pet him. Whoo, man, he turned into a kite. So yes, I have experienced that.
Oh, so I'm not alone. I feel so much better.
Oh, no. And I think it's a perfect example of, I think I've told the story on here before. It's a story that Harry Whitney tells about you know, I won't go into the whole thing, but you're in a dark and it's dark and stormy night and you're in a log cabin. And, you know, he takes the students through this whole story about the phone rings, no one's there, the door, someone knocks on the door, no one's there. So obviously you're getting more amped as time goes on, as this night goes on, you're alone in this dark cabin. And then all of a sudden the lights go out, you're stumbling around for a flashlight, a candle, anything, and you run into a table and you just scream bloody murder because the table was like the straw that broke the camel's back. Mm-hmm. And the story is told to explain, like, why is my horse spooking at this water hose he's seen every day? Or at the beginning of the day, he didn't spook at this mailbox, but coming home from the trail, all of a sudden he spooked. And it explains the it came out of nowhere moments we have with our horse. And this usually happens on the trail or in situations like your cross country course. You know, it's when our horse just befuddles us and spooks at something that he was fine with earlier, that he never spooks at. And it's really just your horse, our poor horses, they try to be good little soldiers and they internalize so much. And lots of things will happen throughout the day that is just making their anxiety rise, but they keep it bottled up. They're just trying to be good little soldiers and carry on. And then finally, something will tip them over the edge. So is the water obstacle. And now they're just, they cannot contain it anymore. Everything's spilled over and they just, they can't do it. They can't hold it in. And so, you know, it helps people realize that, you know, with your horse, it might not have even been about the water obstacle. It could have just been, I'm trying to be good. I'm trying to be good. I'm trying to, okay, now I can't. And so something that's like benign might be just that thing that tips them over the edge, makes their cup runneth over, and they can't do it anymore. And so does it mean that we can automatically make them fine and solve it? Not always, but it helps us go, okay, it's not about this obstacle that spooked them or this obstacle that spooked them. They just were trying to hold it in and they couldn't anymore. And one piece of advice I would give you with your horse that I think would make a huge difference, and it's something that in the last few years I've really come to understand a lot more, and it's this idea of showing your horse where is home, where are you safe. So with the Mustangs, the first thing that I teach them is look at me. If all else fails, look at me and you'll be okay. Because it's a very practical thing to do, because if they're facing me, it's easier for me to go and touch them and get the halter on them and all of that stuff. But I also teach it, and I teach it to every horse. Look at me. If you can't do anything else, if you can't be calm, if you can't stop your feet from moving, look at me. And I also add a boundary in there, like stay a certain distance away so you don't run me over.
Look at me. Don't sit in my pocket. Yeah.
And I do this at a lot of clinics. I'll do clinics where this horse is at a new arena first time. And as I'm trying to talk and explain what we're going to do today, you know, this horse is fresh. He's just off the trailer. He's in a new arena. Crazy obstacles might be sitting around other horses. And he just keeps going whirly birds around his person. And they can't get him to stop. And they're trying to pull on him and push on him, make him stop. So I take a hold of the horse and I say, okay, horse, you know, I know you are in full on panic right now and I cannot make you be unafraid. I can't force you to stand still. Even if I tied all 4 feet together, that's you. I cannot keep you from wanting to move. And you're a prey animal and I understand that. But here's two things I need you to do and they're very simple. One, stay away from me. Stay out there. So I'll wiggle the rope or do whatever I have to do to give them a safe distance away from me. Just in case they explode, I'm not collateral damage. And the other thing is just look at me. Those two things. And I'll usually explain this as I'm doing it. And at first, especially your horses that have kind of learned to use their people as security blankets, they get to an arena and they only know their person and that's their herd and they don't want to be away from their herd. So they're running them over. So it may take me constantly, get back, get back, get back, get back, get back. And in the meantime, they're also looking around for anything that can save them. Other horses, that maybe their buddy's back in the barn and their buddy's screaming and they're screaming and, oh my God, what are we going to do? I could lunge that horse, and I've had people in clinics try to do this. They're like, I lunged the snot out of her, and she's still crazy. I could make that horse so exhausted he's about ready to colic and tie up, and he would still be terrified. So that doesn't always work. You know, so it's not about trying to get him tired or humble him. So I just play this game of get back there, look at me, get back there, look at me, get back there, look at me. And I might have to tell them this over and over and over and over again for a while. But I keep them on task. Stay back there, look at me, stay back there, look at me, stay back there, look at me. And what invariably happens, whether it takes 2 seconds or 20 minutes, the horse will finally go, they'll drop their head down, they'll still their feet, and they'll lick and chew and lick and chew and lick and chew and lick and chew. And it's because I gave them something to focus on, and I showed them this is where you're going to be safe. Because every time I got them where I wanted, back away from me, facing me, they can move side to side, they can move their feet however they want, as long as it's a distance away from me and they're looking at me. Once they know, okay, this is what I can do, and I release them, I give them big release, like every time they do that. If they don't do that, I do something with their feet and work on them until they're right in that sweet spot. And then I release them and I tell them over and over and over again, here's where you're home. Here's where you're safe. Here's where it's all going to be okay. And once they finally realize that, they just let out all the demons and they're fine. You can do this, applies, you could do this on the ground, you could do this on under saddle. With anything I'm doing with the horse, I want to show him where is home, where are you going to be safe. And in the beginning, with a young horse, I might have to put them in that spot over and over again, like, I need you here, I need you here, I need you here, I need you here, and remind them constantly, this is where you ought to be, and release them every time they get there. And then allow them the chance to stay there or make the mistake of leaving. So I'm not going to, once they're in that spot, I want them, I'm not going to force them to stay there. If you leave, I'm going to put you back there, but I'm going to allow you the choice of leaving. For a moment, I'm not going to just let you run off.
That, I think that's key, though, is allow them to leave and then put them right back. That's because, and that's very interesting because,
and yeah,
go ahead, what's going to happen? I have more. Finish that up, and then I have more.
Oh yeah, what should happen over time? In the beginning, I may have to tell that horse often, this is where I need you. This is where you're safe. This is where you're home. But if you are very consistent with that and you're very consistent on making quote unquote home feel great, you could reward it with clicker training. You could reward it with a huge release of pressure and show them, I'm not going to bother you here. Then the interesting thing that will happen is your horse will learn to put himself there, because anytime something scary happens, he's going to remember, where is home? Where do I feel safe? Where am I not bothered? Where's all the pressure going to go away? Right here. And that is how you get your horse to stay with you when something that they haven't been exposed to happens. Because I can desensitize my horse to everything I can possibly think of. I will never get him completely bomb-proof. I could desensitize him to blue tarps all day long, but what if he's never seen a green tarp? Or what if he's fine with tarps at home? Yeah, but tarps at the show are scary, or like a deer on the trail. I can't pay a deer to come by my house every day and scare the daylights out of my horse till they're not scared anymore. So that is what you do to get control of the situation. And it's a big, so anything you do with your horse, you want to show them where's home, where you're going to feel safe, where is everything going to be okay? And they will learn to put themselves in that spot. Yeah. I've had this happen countless times with Mustangs. The first time I lead them out of the safe, controlled, enclosed pen, something scares them. And I can see the wheels turning. They're thinking, run away. But what always happens, if I've done my homework, is they might hit the pressure of that halter and they remember what I told them and they'll yield their hindquarters and look at me. What do I do now? Mm-hmm. And at least in that situation, if they're facing me, I can hold on to them. If they're running backwards, I can still hold on to them. If they're running sideways but looking at me, I can still hold on to them. So it helps keep us both in one piece.
Right. And he's not leaving town. So what I did, the conclusion of our story. And this is a case of, we're getting ahead of ourselves for next month, but this is a case of Nigel's place that's safe that I've been working on since I got him, because he was a bit of a if when something is finally scary, you do a 360 and leave town, was that as long as you listen to my aides, whatever it is you're scared of, we're going to give you a little space, but you have to listen to me so I can tell you where to go.
Perfect.
Okay. So, because his thing was, he wanted to get away from whatever was scary, but we needed to get away safely, right? We didn't need to do it by killing ourselves. So I have to pick up the reins because we were just walking along on a loose rein. And we get him the safe distance away that the reactions became non-life threatening. Now, it was very important here in that I let him spook. I let him be terrified. I let him snort. He would stop and throw on the brakes and back up three steps when the color of the ground changed. All that stuff was allowed as long as, oh my God, okay, I'm listening to you. Oh my God, okay, I'm listening to you. As long as he kept facing me again, I wanted to let him spook because you hear all the time about people who have horses that spook. I'm using my air quotes, the horses that spook. And they constantly spook until they pick up the reins and put the horse on the bit and make him behave. Well, the horse is still terrified, but you've put him into a teensy weensy little package that he can't get away from what's scary.
And now he's dynamite.
Now he's dynamite waiting to happen. And I wanted to avoid going back to that place where he started, where that's how he felt. He felt like if he gave me any indication at all that he would be scared, I would package him up. Okay, you can spook. Just a little spook. It's okay. We'll go further away. We'll come back. We'll go further away. We'll come back. And we just kept making giant circles around the jump with his little friend that he had been riding with all day long. We started out with the friend between him and the jump. Oh, that's comforting. Then we walked behind the friend. Then we walked in front of the friend. Tiny little steps that got him geographically closer to what he thought was terrifying. And if his threshold went up, in other words, he went from little bits of spooks to snorting and jigging, we'd go back to the outside and then come back. So that each time he showed me that he was terrified, it's like, okay, let me take some of the pressure off. But I'm going to take the pressure off you. You don't need to leave town. It's just unnecessary. And it took about 15 or 20 minutes. And we got to the point where we could walk way around it. Maybe we got down to about 50 feet away. And we could walk over the undulating terrain and around and through and in between all of the jumps that surrounded very close to it. To the point where he finally went back to long, loose rein. Oh, I don't need to spook so much. I'm cool again. Took about 20 minutes. But I kind of gave myself a pat in the back because previously, I would have one of two options. Option A would have been put my leg on him, put that bugger together, make him trot around that thing till he's tired to the point where I can literally control him enough to make him get close enough. Not that he wanted to do it or he had made the choice to get close to it, but I could control him enough to get him close to it. Okay, that would have been option one. My other option would have been, let's just set that aside to another day.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that this in-between one, what'll happen next time, if previous experience has been any indication, what'll happen next time, we'll get close to that. The reaction's going to be smaller because he's going to know he has a choice. He knows he can just stop or walk further away from it and have a much smaller reaction because he will not anticipate being smashed into a package and made to face up to the fact that I'm sorry, you're terrified of snakes, but you're going to hold that thing anyway. He's not going to have that visceral reaction. So tiny little steps and letting him be afraid. It's okay. You can be afraid. We'll move over here. Now we're going to come back because you paid attention to me. Now we're going to move over here. And paying attention to my aids is no longer automatically mean you're going to make me get closer to the scary things. Sometimes paying attention to my aids means we're going to move away from the scary thing. And we're going to go over here and do 20 meter circles for a while. Oh, thank you very much for talking to me and telling me to trot. For him, that was a release of pressure.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. I think that's a terrific way to go about it. And I think we tend to underestimate the ability to give your horse what I call throwaway rides. And I first really learned about this. I was working for big time reining guy. He's like maybe $3 million by now. So really big, big time trainer. And his program is pretty aggressive with horses. He's very fair with them, but these are maturity level horses. By the end of their three-year-old year, they're showing at the top levels of the sport. So he drew a hard line when training these horses. He wasn't super sentimental and, oh, we're just going to give you all the time in the world. So for this trainer to impart this lesson on me, I think it shows me how valuable it was. We took a bunch of three-year-olds and older Derby horses to a fairly big but local show. And the three-year-olds, I don't even think we were showing them at this point. They were just coming along for the ride. But on the first day, and these shows last forever, so that you do have the benefit of several days before you actually have to put your horse in the class. But on day one, he told me to get all the three-year-olds out. And these horses are already performing at a high level at home. I mean, they're looking amazing, riding around one-handed, stopping, spinning, lead changing, rollbacks, you name it. But he told me to do is trot them around the rail. If they want to stick their head up and out of frame and look around, let them, you know.
Sorry.
Don't let them run off or completely clock out. But and that's all I did on ride one was, hey, you're in the arena, trot around. And we did that on every horse before the next ride. We came in the next day and we're like, okay, now it's time to business. We got a show to win. So even this person who has horses performing at a high degree and is very demanding in his training program, let these, especially these young horses, have one ride where it's like, I don't care if you drop your shoulder, you come out of frame, we're not going to do lead changes and this and that and the other. You're just here. Look around. Here's your chance. And whatever happens, happens. You know, I'm going to keep you sane and listening to me. I'm not going to get bucked off, but we're not going to, you know, you don't want to make that first ride like, you know, bam, be on the bit and on point, because you just make it, you'll make the experience horrible for them. And you'll just fight them the whole time. And now you've started everything off on a bad foot.
You'll have a maintenance headache on your mind because you're going to have to continuously maintain. They were not able to take it all in the first time. So they're going to keep trying to take it all in. So you're going to have to constantly fight against that natural behavior. It's a little bit like when you get to your hotel room, you throw your bags on the floor, on the bed or whatever, and you look around, don't you? You open the bathroom door, you figure out where the light switches are, you yank back the covers, make sure everything goes cool, you open the window, see if the air conditioner works. And that, I'm sure at a subconscious level, it makes you feel comfortable with your space.
Take it all in.
Take it all in. Well, and that's what we're letting our horse do. And that's a great, I like that. I'm going to chop that one out and I'm going to put that on Horse Tip Daily. So if you don't listen to Horse Tip Daily, that's where you're going to find a lot of these conversations all smooshed down into little tiny bites if you're not one who likes to listen to longer shows. But you're listening to this one, so you're probably somebody who likes longer shows. So I need to have a drink of water. So let's have a quick break for our title sponsor, Horseware. And Horseware distributes a product called IceVod. And if you don't have your Christmas list filled out yet, you need to go to horseware.com and look up IceVod, because it's an amazing product, not just for horses who have issues. It's a great product and a lot of science behind it for horses who compete at every level, and you want to keep them as sound and happy as possible. So we'll be right back.
In the world of horse racing and elite equestrian sports, it's all about how to prepare and repair. IceVibe is a truly portable and highly efficient circulation therapy system for your horse. Before activity, prepare to prevent damage by using the IceVibe's vibration pads. Repair after the event by using the unique combination of cold packs and vibration to minimize swelling and encourage blood flow. And because it's battery powered, IceVibe is truly portable. The essential and affordable tool to prepare and repair. IceVibe.
You can find out more details about IceVibe at ice-vibe.com or horseware.com, or ask your local tack shop or online supplier for more information about IceVibe circulation therapy from Horseware.
And Merry Christmas to you. You should put that on your list. They're well worth the investment. Mary's here. Mary Kitzmiller is here the second Thursday of every month, where the two of us get to sit down and geek out on all things horse training. Regardless of your discipline, your style, the part of the country you live in, doesn't matter. It's all about horse training. And we're going to answer some listener questions now. These are questions that get posted on the Horse Radio Network auditor's Facebook page, which is where all the cool kids hang out because they're auditors. What happens is people who listen into the Horse Radio Network shows, Horses in the Morning being one of them, find value in it. So they go on over to horseradionetwork.com or horsesinthemorning.com, and they click on the auditor banner. It's usually on the right-hand side of the page. And they provide as little as a buck a month to help support Horse Radio Network programming and the things that go on here. And that gets you into the Horse Radio Network Auditor's Facebook page, where we chat about all things horse. So pick a question from this giant list. Oh my gosh, you must have 50 questions here. Pick one of these from the list, and let's delve into it.
Okay, so I'm going to start with one that relates to this whole theme we've been talking about, and it's from Ashley Mitchell, and she said, how can you slow the pace without constantly using the reins, especially when working a young horse that has a very fast canter, but you need them to slow down just a little, but don't want to pull on the reins or bunch them up in the neck. I assume having the horse like...
Yeah.
Really short. Yeah.
Curly neck. Got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't want a curly neck.
So when I do, this is how I start with young horses and with training horses. What I like to do is first teach them a one rein stop because I'm going to work on being able to shut my horse down and then bring the speed up again. So I like a one rein stop to start over like trying a half halt or bring them down with two reins, because I think it helps hammer the point home and it helps keep you from getting in the habit of pulling back on two reins. So one rein stop, real quick crash course. I tip the horse's head to the left or the right. I use literally one rein. I do not use the outside rein when I do this. And I ask them to yield their hindquarters all the way down until they stop moving their feet and then soften to my rein. So it's what I would consider a lateral maneuver. So once I have that, I practice that walk, trot, canter, make sure I can shut them down from every speed. And initially I do this with colts just to try to shut things down. If they want to buck me off or run off or do something really crazy, I can just get control, shut everything down, regroup, try again. So once I've gotten that out of the way, like I know I can shut you down any speed, you know what's up. Then I start working on speed control. So ideally, I would like to be able to move my horse at walk, trot, and canter on a loose rein down to the buckle if I want and have them not build speed. I don't care in the beginning how fast their gait is, as long as I don't sense them building speed, if that makes sense. So if their canter is a little quick, but I don't feel them canter faster every stride, I'm going to let them go. Because most horses, when they're allowed to travel on a loose rein and you get to practice this for long periods of time, they're going to find their own steady cadence. And it's actually, even on a more quick-footed horse, it can be pretty dang slow and relaxing.
Yeah, it's funny how you hang on, and then you're right. If you let them speed up a little bit, and then they do, and once they realize there's nothing to hold on to, there's no rein to pull on, they go, oh, well, I'm good here.
Oftentimes, that is all that it takes. Just stop pulling on them. And most, with a lot of horses, that's enough for them to go, oh, thank God, you know, and they'll just
slow down. The pulling is
actually
causing them to speed up. Yeah.
Yeah. Horses tend to want to lean against pressure before they understand to give to it. So you pull on them, they pull against you, then you pull harder against them, and then they pull harder against you. And
it all goes to hay in a handbag.
Yeah. Now it's a freight train. So I give them a very simple rule. I'll start them off at whatever gate I choose, and their job is to continue in that gate until I tell them to do otherwise. So with your speedy horse, I'll start them off on a walk. This, even if you know it's the canter where your problem is, it helps to work on this in the lower gates first. And I bet you this crops up even in the walk if you have a horse that's pretty speedy in the canter. I'll let them walk. I used to even just let them go wherever the heck they wanted in the arena, as long as I had, you know, in close fencing and I wasn't going to run into anybody else. I just let them go wherever, loose rein. And let's say I start feel him speeding up in that walk. Now, our knee-jerk reaction is to grab hold of him to make, you know, keep the bad things from happening. But he doesn't really learn that way. So I will allow him to get speedier in the walk. But as soon as he breaks gait into trot, I'm going to gently bring him down, spiral him down with that one rein stop, shut him down. And then I'm going to wait a moment and ask for a walk again. Now, some of your really hot, anxious horses, you might get 2 steps, have to shut them down. 2 steps, shut them down. 2 steps, shut them down. It doesn't matter. I will continue to give them every opportunity to do the right thing until they realize that, oh, you know what? I'm not bothered if I just stay in the walk. And I practice this at the trot and I practice this at the canter. So at the trot, I have the same rules. I will let them trot bigger, 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 faster, faster, faster. I will let it happen as long as I feel safe. You know, if at any point I don't feel safe, I'll shut them down. But, you know, if everything else is going well, but they're speeding up, allow it to happen. But once they break gait into canter, okay, nope, that's not what I wanted. I wanted trot, shut them down. And I'll do that over and over. You can't do this too much. Thousands of these. And in the canter, obviously, he only has one place to go out of the canter, and it's into straight gallop. I don't want him to get all the way to running off before I shut him down, because that can be a little scary. So my rule for the canter is I'm going to ask you to canter. I'm going to leave you alone unless I can sense you building speed. If I feel those each canter stride getting faster and faster and faster, I'm going to shut you down. And I'm not going to try to punish him. The one rein stop isn't punished, because oftentimes a horse that's speedy is speedy because they're really anxious. So if I rip on those reins really fast or get after him, I'm giving him all the more reason to be crazy because he's worried about getting punished. So I'm always slow to pick up. I'm going to draw him gently down, down, down. I may really have to take a hold of him to do it, but I'm going to be very slow and fluid with my hands and then quick to release him as soon as he comes down to that stop and softens.
I have a point to make here. I only very recently, because I'm an old person, learned what a one rein stop was. Now, mind you, it was 10 years ago, but that's relatively recent for me. And it was on an OTTB who was extremely high energy and extremely anxiety ridden. And I had to learn to do it with a rope halter on, which was also my first experience with a rope halter.
Oh, fun.
But it was, I'm so glad that Kim taught me this way, because it simply illustrated how effective it can be when done properly. We did it at the walk, we did it at the trot, and then before we did it to the canter. But because we had done our homework at the walk and the trot, and I was taught to pay attention to my whole body, when I picked up the rein to ask for a one rein halt, was I inadvertently encouraging the horse to go forward with my other aids? Because this was a remedial horse. This wasn't a starter. So if I was leaning forward and my leg was closing on her inside rib cage at the same time I was picking up her rein, I was telling her to go faster. Of course she's not going to stop, right? So I kind of had to learn the whole body. But because we did our homework, by the time we got to canter, it was seamless. Picked up the inside rein, brought her nose towards my toe. And what that morphed into in very short order, in the same lesson, as a matter of fact, when her canter got a little bit fast and a little bit unbalanced, all I had to do was pick up my inside rein and gently turn her nose 2 degrees, and she slowed down. And I dropped the rein again because I'd done my homework. But
this
was a horse who already knew walk, trot, canter. She was a 3-foot show jumper at that point in her life, but needed some help. Things had gone awry. So when you're teaching a horse that this horse seems to already know what lope canter is, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But if you're in that spot where you have a horse that has training but needs to relearn the basics, or a human that helps needs to help them relearn those basics, I'm so glad you started that conversation with start at the walk. Do the trot.
Yes.
And if it's not working at the walk and it's not working at the trot, easily and comfortably and within threshold, you ask the horse to come to a one rein halt from a trot, take a deep breath, let go of both reins. And he doesn't do the same. If he's sitting there breathing fire, you haven't gotten it yet. This should be something that helps the horse reset and reboot and go, okay, I've got it. Right?
Right.
Right. There we go. Awesome.
Yeah. And okay, so this comes back to everything is everything else.
Yeah.
most of the time when we have a problem with the canter, I guarantee you I can point out the breakdown in your lower gates. When your canter is crap, I can guarantee your walk and trot aren't so good either. But we tend to only focus on the canter because that's where it gets really scary. And sometimes you'll have a horse. I was talking with Craig Johnson. He had a futurity level horse. This horse is trained perfectly. He's at a high level. He took him to a show, and the horse, there was no stop, which is kind of important in reining. Mm-hmm. They need to stop on well. This horse just lost his stop. So what he could have done, and this was kind of the knee jerk. This is sort of what your instincts want you to do, is, well, this is where it's breaking down when I run down and ask you for, well, you don't do it. So what a lot of guys, you'll see a lot of guys out there till 3 a.m, run down, pull on the horse, punish him, get him back, let's get the different bit out, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And even if you fix the problem that way, you have run out of horse by the end of it. He is whooped. So your horse is not in peak condition to show. So the panic sets in because you got to show like tomorrow and this horse isn't stopping. But what Craig did was genius. He went back to the walk. Walk forward a few steps, stop, gently back up. Like just treated it like, let's just go back to kindergarten for a few minutes. And he, you know, then he did it at the trot. Trot forward, stop, back up. Trot forward, stop, back up. Trot forward, stop, back up. And then he was ready to do the canter. He went trot, 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 canter, canter, stop, back up. Trot, 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 canter, canter, stop, back up. By the time it was time to show, horse had his stops back. Even though he'd hardly cantered the horse at all before the show, he did it all at the walk and the trot. So that's
down into small steps. There
yes.
You go.
One last thing I'll add to this is be very mindful of your seat and what your seat is telling your horse. A lot of people on fast horses have electric seats. It looks like every time their seat hits the saddle, they're shocking their horse like an electric fence. And a lot of this is because the horses, one thing causes the other, which, you know, it's like your horse is fast, which causes you to be tense, which causes your horse to go fast, which causes you to be tense. And this vicious cycle occurs. And I helped a lady at my clinic this last weekend. Her horse was too fast at the lope. And I said, okay, show me what you're talking about. And the horse picked up the lope. And she is leaning forward, riding on her pelvis. Everything is tense. And she's matching that horse stride for stride. So her seat's telling that horse, go faster. And I told her, I said, you look like you're on a cross-country course, which is like you're, you know, as you're galloping about, you're kind of up in 2 point, telling the horse, go, go, go. So this is very hard, very counterintuitive, but no matter how fast that horse goes, you keep your seat slow. So you sit down on the pockets of your jeans. You have you can sacrifice some poor equitation and sort of collapse your core and become like bags of sand in that saddle and just relax. And even when you're doing these one rein stops, that's something else you need to think about before you pick up. If you decide you want to shut your horse down, as long as your horse isn't like in a full-blown runoff and you have time to work on this, sit down, breathe out, make sure your legs are off your horse, not like hanging on, you know, way off their sides, but not squeezing them.
Yeah, you don't want to be inadvertently saying go, go, go while your hands say stop, stop, stop. Right.
And count one Mississippi, two Mississippi, and then bring them down to a stop. And every time you think I need to pick up and do a run rein stop, sit down, relax, breathe out, one Mississippi, two Mississippi, one rein stop. If you are consistent with that, then one of these times when you sit down, relax, that horse is going to go, I know what's coming, and start to slow down. And you can start to work that into your favor in the canter. When they want to go fast, do not lean forward. Don't lean forward onto your inner thighs. I want you to sit back, roll with that horse, be deep in that saddle, and anchor yourself down and relax and breathe, because that can stop quickness so much faster. That can stop it in its tracks before they even think about going. So be really mindful of your seat is another piece of advice I'd give there.
Gold stars and sparkles.
There Yay! We go.
All right. We need to cover what's going on with your new Mustang, and then we'll do another question from our many, many listeners here. So give us the quick backstory of the current Mustang, because there's so many in your life.
So yes, I have Dougal, who is my 2020 Extreme Mustang Makeover horse. So we will be showing in January. And yesterday, day 67, I think it was, we did ride one. So I'm super proud of him. And this all relates to breaking things down. I've saddled Dougal. I've stood in the stirrups. I've long lined him. He's used to the snaffle. He's doing lateral work, long lining now. But for that first ride, I thought, because this is a horse that can go from zero to, oh my God, really quickly. And he's a big horse.
And
so
he spends
most
of his time at zero, doesn't he? He looks very chill.
Yeah, he's mostly chill, but then he can get airborne in the most unexpected moments. And I'm like, wow, okay. So I wanted to really break down this first ride and make it as something he can understand as clearly as possible. So he's ready for me to step in the stirrup and get on with the saddle. But I wanted to make sure that I would do it bareback first, just so he had this concept of person on your back. And the bareback I like to do because if they're ever not okay, it's really easy for me to bail. I just come clean off of them before anything happens. Mm-hmm. And that close contact with the horse, I do an exercise called human curry comb. Which is pretty much, it's exactly what it sounds like. If you don't have horse hair from head to toe all over your body by the time it's over, you haven't done it right. So you're using your body to like curry all the winter coat off your horse.
Basically doing is you're taking, the horse is comfortable at this point with human touch from your hands, mm-hmm. right? You touch him all over with your hands and your grooming tools. He's cool with that. And mm-hmm. you're just taking that whole process and taking your feet off the ground so your body is on the horse while it does this. So when you, in preparation for the human curry comb, where you stepped from a mounting block onto his back, did you stand on the mounting block and lay over him, stand on the mounting block, rub him all over with your hands and elbows? Was that sequential, or did you just go from
yes.
standing on the ground to getting on his back?
Yes, I did it. I did it in tiny steps. And normally I like to do human curry comb without a mounting block so I can jump onto their back. But he's tall and I'm old. So I taught him to line up to the mounting block. But
teaching him to line up to the mounting block, you taught him to come over to the mounting block and stand next to it where you would to be mounted
exactly.
all on his own. You didn't touch him at all to do that.
I totally did. Yeah. So, and this all relates to the epiphany that each of the students had at the last three clinics that I did. So, as it would happen, I had three separate clinics all ask, can you show me how to get my horse up to the mounting block? And in, you know, one student's case, her horse had never done it before and wasn't lining up to the mounting block. The other two, their horses usually did sort of kind of, but now were not. And they couldn't figure out how to get them to line up where they need to be for a person to get on and to stay there. And so I showed them, I have two different ways to teach it. One is like a trick where you actually get them to swing their hip toward you. That's a whole other show. And I don't like to teach it often, because once you teach them to swing their hip at you, they like to offer that behavior a lot. And that's scary.
Be careful
like,
of teaching a horse any behavior, because they will volunteer
yeah.
it sometimes at inappropriate moments. Yes.
Yeah. So like you're going to pick up their foot and they slam their butt into you. And, you know, the few horses I've been through this with, they'll do that. And at first I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to die. And then I'm like, oh no, you're offering that thing you like to do. Okay. So I don't really like to teach that, because I could tell people that till they're blue in their face, but they're still going to go through it themselves. So the other way that I do it is it's stupid easy, really simple. I don't use a whip. I use whatever headgear they have on. If it's a bridle, great. If it's their halter and lead rope, great. And you could do this from a fence or a mounting block. And I usually have a basis of groundwork by the time I'm to the mounting block. So I can yield their hindquarters. I can bring them forward. I can ask them to back up. I can move their shoulders. So I have some basics there. And excuse me, I just get on the mounting block and I think, what would I have to do with this lead rope or rein in my hand to get you to come where I need you to do? So there's no special magical cue or step. I just kind of start picking up that lead rope and fiddling with the horse until they do something that slightly resembles mounting block. So usually that's the first time they'll take a step forward, and then I release. So again, this is where this epiphany occurred. This is where these people were not understanding how to get the mounting block done, is they were thinking the finished product, which is my horse walks up to the mounting block, lines his saddle area up right to my hands, and I swing on and ride off. They think that, and they don't reward all the wonderful things their horse is giving them on the way to that. So in the beginning, I'm like, hey, you didn't run off when I stood up high, which Dougal tried to do the first time because he doesn't like people higher than him. Scares the heck out of him. So that's where we started. And then I said, can you come a little closer? Great. Oh, I love you. Pet on you. Kiss, kiss, kiss. Love, love, love. Cookies. Can you come a little closer now? Now a little closer. And then what I started doing was I would just send him back and forth to where he was passing me. So I'd have him go past the mounting block, yield his hindquarters, come back the other way. And we just did that over and over again. Just walk past me. And I tried to stay on the mounting block as best I could. If he ever got stuck and I had to leave the mounting block, I would. But I just tried to keep my feet on the mounting block. And then I would just shorten the distance of him passing me until I could kind of lead him by and then release all the pressure when he got near. So this is sort of hard to explain, but the secret is ask, release, ask, release, ask, release, reward anything that even smells like the finished behavior, anything. I don't care if it doesn't look like what it's supposed to. If they come forward and they weren't doing that before, great. If they got their neck sort of lined up with the mounting block and they weren't doing that before, terrific. And make them feel good for doing it. And I like to throw it through several times throughout the session. So I'll get them a little close to it. And then, oh, let's go work on our cantering. And I'll, you know, work on something. And they're probably a little tired and they want to stand and rest. I'm like, yeah, let's go do this mounting block thing again, because it's really low energy and you could breathe and rest and feel good while we're playing with this. So they're going to start craving that mounting block because they get to go there every time they need a rest. And over time, I will get them to that mounting block. And it usually takes me about 5 minutes. But the cool thing that happens is if you constantly show them, here's where I want you, and then make them feel amazing for doing it, pretty soon you're going to step on that mounting block. And then before you even like have your reins adjusted, they're there. And that's what I'm looking for. And that's what I've done with Dougal. And so that mounting block is home. This is where you're safe. This is where everything's okay. So then when I started climbing on his back, he was like, weird, but okay. And it wasn't this big, scary thing for him because I did it really slowly. And I did it at a place that he had learned to really love being, which is by his precious mounting block.
His precious, my precious.
Yes. Yes.
Picture in my head of Gollum. And if you don't know who Gollum is, go Google that. Well, that's fascinating stuff. Again, tiny steps, rewarding small efforts towards your end goal. I think we, as horse trainers, and we're all horse trainers because every time you're around your horse, you're training it, either good or bad or otherwise, learning to be more observant and then taking those observations and then putting them into context, I think,
yeah.
is
and
one
speaking
of
the context, you know, let's say, let's put yourself in the horse's place. Let's say you know, it's your first day of school. You don't know anything or much about math at all. And someone puts on the chalkboard, it looks like Good Will Hunting or Einstein's Theory of Relativity or something crazy like that. They put this huge, convoluted, beautiful mind-looking equation on the board and they look at you and say, solve it. And you're just like, oh my God, you know, I don't know 2 + 2. What am I going to do with this? And let's say you finally get up the courage to pick up the chalk and try to solve it. And the first number you write down, they say wrong and slap the chalk out of your hands. Are you going to want to try and solve that equation? It's already way too much for you to handle. And you know, you tried a little, you know, you finally like got the courage up within you to try and you were shut down for trying. So what I would do at that point is shove my, you know, chair back and cross my arms and say, you know, screw you, I'm not doing this. That's not how we teach people. We teach them, here's 2 + 2. Here's what numbers are. You know, here's how we add. Here's how we subtract. And we add more complication, more challenge to it over time until we can learn to solve these complex equations. But each step along the way that we're successful, we get rewarded for it, or we should. So like with the trailer, let's say your horse is walking to that trailer, shaky kneed, and he's like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I can't do this, can't do this. You know, that's what he's thinking in his head. And we're just walking along, not paying attention. And we ask our horse to get on the trailer. And let's say he is able to make a Herculean effort and put his fears away, and he puts a foot in that trailer. You might not realize it, but for that horse, that was a huge threshold he crossed over. He put away his fears and he tried. But what do we often do? We don't see that and think, yes, great job, and give him a break, let him back off the trailer, think about it, or at least stop what we're doing and let him just bask in it for a moment. Because it doesn't look like what we want, which is all 4 feet in the trailer, door closed, blah, 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 down the road. We keep asking and poking and prodding on the horse, even though he made that huge step. So he puts a foot in the trailer, and what does he feel? Whip, 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 tap, 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 pull, pull, pull on that lead rope. And I've seen this and I've experienced this myself countless times. That horse puts 1 foot in the trailer, and then that is the last time he put a foot in the trailer before it got dark outside and we're all crying.
And that is so frustrating when you have a situation where you're trying to load a horse and early on they do get a hoof in and that's the last thing you ever get. That is so infuriating. But you're right. It's what we perceive as difficult for the horse and what he sees as difficult can be worlds apart.
Yeah, in that horse's mind, he overcame a huge amount of fear and he tried for you and he put a foot in and we didn't acknowledge it in any way. And he only continued to feel pressure for that effort. So then he goes, nope, not worth it. I am not doing it. And that's why that behavior right there, I've heard people tell that story. I've been there myself. He started to go right in and then he never went in again. It's because you didn't let him have it, you know. So you could have saved hours of time if he puts a step in and you just wait and just say, oh man, just have that for a moment. Just think about that. That's amazing that you did that. Or in the case of an extremely fearful horse, I might just back him right back off that trail. Let's go have some grass for a minute. And then let's see about 2 feet, then 3 feet, then 4 feet. And I will not close that door unless I'm sure you're going to stand on there for a moment, for long enough for me to get it closed. If he gets on and he thinks about backing up, I'm like, it's okay. Get off. Get off if you need to. I can always put you back on. I got you on the first time. We'll get on again. But giving them that freedom to, it's okay to say no and have a moment. I'm going to ask you to do it again, but I'm going to let you make the choice to get off. So I don't know where I was initially going with this whole thing, but that's kind of the whole thing I wanted to, what each of these people said, the people I was talking about with the epiphany, what they each said when they saw me demonstrate mounting block, they were like, oh, I didn't realize I could have rewarded the steps along the way. They just see my horse isn't lined up to the mounting block. And that's wrong.
Yeah.
It's a horse that's done it before. A lot of times horses do it, but they don't really know how. And that's why it falls apart.
So what you just said, looking for places where we can reward versus looking for places where we can add pressure. I think when we train, because we've got a vision, I'm going to teach that horse to come to the mounting block. The horse does not have that agenda. We need to look more for places to reward and less for places to add pressure.
Exactly. I'm always wanting to know, when can I stop with the pressure? When can I release? If you horse train, I go in there and I know I will use the pressure it takes. And I may have to get very firm with this horse, you know, because sometimes we're dealing with life and death. You cannot come into my space because you'll hurt me. So I will use every bit as much as I have at my disposal, but I don't go into a situation thinking, how much pressure can I use? I think, when can I release? When is the moment I can stop and tell them, great job, you tried? Because when you do that, you're going to start really laser focusing in on those moments like, oh man, you took a step toward the mounting block. And when I first walked on this thing, you were wanting to pull backwards because you were scared seeing me from that height. So, you know, great job doing that. And yeah. Okay, give them a moment. Now, can you give me a little bit more?
Yeah, cool. Well, we have time for one more.
Oh my God.
One more. Oh my gosh. One more listener question. Pick a good one.
Okay.
No pressure.
So let's see. I had it in my head. Oh, this is a good one by Ursina Studhalter. What a cool name.
What an awesome name.
I
know.
Correctly. How do you regain the trust of a horse that has been abused? I have a hyper mare. She doesn't seem to actually startle at anything, but absolutely nothing escapes her notice. The flight instinct is strong. She's okay with one handler, but gets very defensive with a second handler. She was held down and whipped across her back legs. Oh, that's awful. She's very rushy to lead. To make the long story short, how do I help her relax? She's totally okay with my presence, even let me fix her blanket. No fuss last night. But if I want to do something like lead her from the dry lot to the arena, I have a mess on my hands.
Ooh, wow, that's a biggie.
Yeah. So the reason I picked this question is this horse needs to know where she's safe. So this all strings into everything I've been talking about. So if I had this mare in training, I would be mindful of her past, but I would treat her like any other horse. Because if we tiptoe too much around them, it can actually make things worse. I think they just want normalcy. They want consistency. They want to know where they're going to be safe. So where I would start with this horse is where I would start with a wild Mustang and just pretend she knows nothing. And for the things she does know, those parts will go through really quick. For the things she doesn't know, it shows me, okay, there's a hole or there's some trauma. Here's what we can work on. So, and I actually start this place with every single horse. I would start by teaching her to face up. So I'm pretty simple with what I do. I used to round pin them first, like walk, trot, canter around the round pin before I got them to hook on. But now I actually start with the facing up process before I move them out. So you can do this in her stall. You need to be very mindful and don't get yourself in a position to get kicked. Use low, low pressure. You could do this in a round pin. Round pin is probably your best place, or her dry lot, you know, a reasonably contained area. You could do this in a pasture, but that's a challenge. And I will teach the horse, when I'm in here, I want you to look at me. So how I do that, and I'm borrowing this from a program called 4BP, but I'll kind of hold my hands out in front of me and I might give a cue. I might tell them to face up. You don't have to. I don't really do that too much anymore, but I kind of hold my hands in front of me. They're not going to know what that means. And I'm going to clap them together until the horse looks at me. Now, a wild Mustang, usually it takes me moving very little and they put their eyes right on me and I can release pressure. On a domestic horse, even an abused one, they've kind of learned to half ignore people. So I've found myself doing jumping jacks, like, just look at me. Because they've learned that, you're not a big deal. And, they'll turn their butt towards you. So yeah. I will do whatever I can. And I usually do this without any kind of whip or rope. It usually doesn't take any more than just me making a ruckus. And
so
then
wait, let's stop there for a second.
Yes.
So you are in an enclosed, safe area.
Mm-hmm.
You face the horse. You clap your hands or jumping jacks. Or you're doing something physically and audibly that is supposed to get the horse's attention.
Yes.
The horse is not necessarily going to spin around, face you with his ears up. Are you going to reward an effort in that direction? In other words, I'm standing in the middle, horse's kind of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, going, oh my God, how do I get out of here? I face the horse, I leap in the air and I clap twice and he slows down and puts one ear on me. Am I going to reward that and then do it again? Or am I going to keep doing it until the horse stares right at me?
In this case, I am going to try to get them to look directly at me. Very few times I've had to concede and say, well, you put one on me, I'll take it. And I want to block any kind of movement they make, because some horses can get in the habit of just running, especially right, if they have been round
penned badly. They're just going to run around.
They just run around and around and around. So I will block them, do whatever it takes to get them to stop and look at me. As soon as they do that, I get the heck out of Dodge. I back away. You can turn and walk away if it's safe, but I create huge amount of distance between us. I'll sort of cross my arms and I'll get really small. I'll look down and just take all the pressure off and say, this is where we start. This is where the pressure's off. So a lot of times if they're anxious, they might go to moving around and looking around the round pen again. I kind of hold my hands out in front of me first before I make any kind of noise. And that'll become a cue. Like when my hands come out in front of me, that means face up. So I'll do that first. And if they don't respond, which they won't initially, I'll clap my hands, do what I might, slap my jeans, whatever it takes. Or I might block if I clap my hands and they respond by running, I'll block them back and forth and just get them to face up, back off, back off, back off as soon as they do. And I'll do this over and over and over again until they get this idea that looking at me is safe. This is where everything's going to be okay because all the pressure's off here. Once I get that pretty consistent, I can get them to look at me really quickly without running around. Then what I'm going to start to do is say, okay, no matter where I move in this pen, continue to look at me. So I'll walk a few steps to the right. I'll kind of hold my hands out in front of me again and ask them to face up. I might have to use pressure to do so. And then I'll play that game until no matter where I walk, they keep their nose on me. And as they do that, you'll naturally get a brilliant hindquarter yield out of them, because in order to face you, they often have to yield their hindquarters. So I'll play that game to where no matter where I am in the pen, continue to look at me. So you're going to have to move your body around to keep your eyes on me. And I do this with horses that are rushy to lead, that have pulled the lead rope out of people's hands before, that want to run past or spook, or this prevents me having to dirt ski alongside my horse, because I'm creating this little fire drill of when you hear something crazy or something makes a commotion, look at your person, and that's where you're safe. So their first reaction when I make any kind of energy is to run, but I teach them over time, look at me, and that's where I'm going to start. From there, I'll start approaching and retreating and working on petting them and loving them, and that's where I can really make facing me feel really good. Once, you know, every time they face up to me, when we work on our groundwork, anything else, I'm going to rub on their face and tell them, hey, everything's okay. So that is just a very small piece of where I would start with that horse, is just always get two eyes. There's also a really great, because we're running out of time and I can't go into my huge novel explanation for this question. I would recommend Buck Brannaman's Groundwork Book. It's a very simple, red little book, very non-assuming. You don't have to do the lariat work that's in it, but it's got some really good exercises to get you started and get your horse working with you and not against you and not against each other. But I'd say the biggest point that I want to drive home with this horse is show her where she's going to be safe, show her where home is. And that's where you're going to release all the pressure. And hopefully over time, she's going to learn to find that space on her own.
That's great, because she's going to learn to be quieter and more, because she has to be still while she's staring at. Well, she doesn't have to be. She will learn that being still is easy and comfortable and safe. Oh, I like this a lot. I really want to hear from Ursina as you start to work on this. I want to hear from you how it's working. So go back to the HRN Auditor's Facebook page and give us updates, because I'm very excited. This habit is not that uncommon, believe it or not. You find a lot of horses who just want to run right past you on lead rope, especially when things get a little scary. And what a great way to deal with that issue versus just putting a chain over their nose.
Yeah, you know, because the chain will relent to a degree, and I don't want to bash. There's very few tools that'll say, "What the heck are you doing? Get that off your horse." But the chain, a chain or a harsher bit or tying your horse's head down or tightening their cavesson, all of those things is putting a Band-Aid on it. It's sort of like if I'm driving down the road, my check engine light comes on. So I respond by punching out my dash till the light doesn't come on. Problem solved. I don't see
Not
it anymore.
Really.
Yeah. So the chain, you know, it sometimes that is what you have to do to be able to get your horse from point A to point B, from point A to point B and survive. So I'm not going to begrudge anyone that, but you've got to find out what the problem is. And it's usually they don't know where they feel safe. So they're looking for anywhere in the world that's going to help them, their friends, their barn, whatever. But if I make a habit of showing them here with me, looking at me, paying attention to me, I'm going to get you through this from day one. No matter what other kind of groundwork program I do, I want to make them know that I'm the safe place. I'm going to help you. It makes a big difference in everything else I do.
Perfect. And one of our other listeners, Patty, wrote in and wanted to know exercises you can do during the winter months that when it's too cold to ride, teaching your horse to face up is one of them. And I would like to thank our title sponsor for Mary Kitzmiller's episode every single month is Horsewear Ireland. You know them well because they have the most amazing blankets on earth, but they also have something called Ice Vibe, a therapy product for horses, sound and slightly less so. It's great for your Christmas list. So go to horsewear.com and check it out. And thank you very much, Mary, for coming to hang out with us and go all geeky on horse training again this month.
Yay, that was fun.